And just off the shores of Lake Michigan here in Chicago, Illinois, big welcome into the first edition of the On the Shore podcast. Hi there, everybody. I'm Lucas Moore. Sitting alongside me, my not lifelong, but feels like lifelong, best friend, Max McDoolin. And we're going to carry you through, hopefully, a long time, not just through the sports world, but through our worlds here in what I think Max and I agree is probably one of the greatest cities in the world, if not the greatest city in the world, Chicago, and our experiences through life and all those fun things. So big welcome into the program, and Max, finally, we got this started. We got a little sidelined with some illness is what happened to us, and that illness kind of really took us out of it, but we're here. We're getting ready to roll. I mean, Christmas season's coming up, so, you know, getting this out consistently, we've still got a rhythm to roll into, but I'm finally excited that we're able to get started.
Well, it couldn't be a better time of year to start off with the first podcast, right? Because we're going to get this thing out there, and our friends and family and those who find us on the Twitterverse or in the social media world, no excuse not to listen. Right?
All yeah, you got have, time.
You got plenty of time this time of year. You know, I know that everyone's filling that time with a lot of family, a lot of food, and a lot of fun. But there's also definitely time in there to listen to a couple guys talk about sports, maybe talk about some movies or some social life, and like you said, about the great city of Chicago and everything else that there is to talk about on a daily basis.
Well, one of those great things we're going to talk about today is Star Wars The Rise of Skywalker opens this week. You and I are pretty large Star Wars fans. I think I'd take the title as a slightly bigger Star Wars fan than you. Oh, we can argue about that a little bit later in the show, perhaps. But we're going to discuss why we're excited for this film, what Star Wars means for us. And then after the movie comes out, we'll probably even do a review episode. But where I wanted to start today is the Cleveland Browns. Because I have joyfully been doubting this football team for a very long time. Really, I've been doubting them since I was 5 years old because they've been the easiest team to doubt since I've been 5 years old. They have failed time and time again, and they just completed a perfect decade, Max. They completed a decade of losing. Not a single winning season in the 2010s for the Cleveland Browns, and this whole thing is just a mess. And what I wanted to talk about with the Cleveland Browns today is, why is this happening? I can stand up here and say how right I was about Baker Mayfield, about Freddie Kitchens, about how this combination wasn't going to work, how the expectations would crumble on a team like this with not proper leadership. But I think this goes beyond more than just this one season. I think it's more of a real cultural thing with the Cleveland Browns. And the question I wanted to ask you is a why question. Is it just an organization? Is it bad luck? Why are the Cleveland Browns the Cleveland Browns?
Well, I mean, I think one of the reasons that the Browns are the Browns is because at some point there has to be a change in the way that your organization is run, and then you have to stick with it for a length of time. And one of the problems that the Browns have encountered year in and year out is that it seems like they have pushed the buttons at the wrong moments historically. And it's just, and a part of that is just in general bad luck. But if you look at, for example, coaches that they held on to maybe too long, coaches like maybe a Romeo Crennel, or maybe coaches too short in their history. If you look at, you know, presidents of operations, general managers who have been given longer leashes versus shorter leashes, you know, and I think that that's the starting point of all of this, is that you say, well, you know, you go look at an organization like the New England Patriots, you know, you look at a guy like Robert Kraft, he has pushed the right buttons for a good length of time now, and it's not just Bill Belichick who has had success in New England, but it's also, a guy like Bill Parcells taking a team to a Super Bowl when Bill Belichick wasn't there yet. So you're talking about management that pushed the right buttons once, then did it again. You look at an organization like the Steelers. They have never fired a coach in their organization's history. That means that as an organization, the Rooney family does a very good job of hiring. They never make a wrong hire. So it starts at the top. How can you be better at the top? And I think the Browns, through different ownership over the years and through an organizational move and then a reinvigoration, I don't think that question has ever been answered. So it starts at the top.
Well, and I think it becomes a thing of, we haven't had success and we want it so fast that you overreach for it. You're not ready to meander on into this. And I think the media hype this offseason mattered. And I kept saying that it mattered. And you saw it on the sidelines this weekend why it matters. Because expectation is the thief of happiness, right?
Yeah.
If you don't expect a lot in life, you're fine with it if you don't get it. But if you expect the world and you don't receive it, if you expect a five-star dinner and you pay $25 for the steak, you expect a good steak, right? But if you pay $6 at a Steak and Shake, you understand what you're paying for. And the Browns put false expectations on themselves and on their team, and they put the wrong leadership in place for those expectations in this offseason. And now you put yourself in a box again where you're probably going to have to go through another firing. And to me, it's a loop that is really, really hard to escape. And I think what makes it hard to escape is this fan base, because they are so ready to win that they aren't ready to let the team lose gradually. And fans might deny that point, but as soon as there's any glimmer of hope, and we've seen this time and time again, we saw this the Trent Richardson, Brandon Weeden draft. We've seen this time and time again. First-round draft picks get excited. Justin Gilbert, Johnny Manziel. They've got talent. They're ready to go. I like this coach's new direction. We're ready to win now. Those things can harm an organization because expectation takes away the happiness. Because the bottom line, if this Browns team had realistic expectations going into this year, right, they're 6-8. Is that really all that awful? I'm not sure. I think that the fans in this case harm the Browns' efforts in trying to make their rebuild successful. Also because, and this is the fault of an organization, they respond to the fans more than a lot of organizations I see around the NFL. They are very, very fan responsive in Cleveland, and that's why they're so loyal, the fans, but it's also why this organization makes a lot of mistakes.
Yeah, and it's also hard not to be fan responsive when your organization exists because of the fans. You know, when you go look at a team down the road in Cincinnati, you know, the Bengals, unfortunately, it is what it is for us Cincinnati fans. The reason that they've never really struggled with when it comes to responding to the public or responding to their fan base, it's because they're not forced into that box or are not created because the fans were so desperate for a team. When you go look at organizations that are, the Houston Texans exist because the fan base lost the Houston Oilers, wanted a football team so bad. The state of Texas loves football. And so in recent years, the Texans, although they built a winning culture the right way, they also at times took steps backwards because they listened to the fan base.
Yeah, but I think even that one, Houston, very major city, yeah, right? They're sure going to need a football team in the NFL. There was no reason for the NFL to go back to Cleveland other than the fans, right? Yeah. So I think your point is spot on that the fans, their passion, their dedication makes this so much harder for the organization not to be fan responsive.
Yeah, no, and I think it absolutely does. And then in addition, I think that's where the question becomes is where do you find the right balance as an organization that's trying to fill those shoes? Because you look at teams like, you know, look at a team maybe like the New England Patriots. They're still every now and then going to make decisions as an ownership group and as a management group that have the fans in mind. But because you're so well run, you're also going to get players who are able to maybe come to some sort of middle ground with you. You're also going to be able to make moves that maybe don't make sense at a moment, but explain them down the road, and it doesn't haunt you. There's also this really interesting culture that exists in Cleveland that's a little bit different. So in Boston, it exists, talking about the Patriots, where there's this massive sports talk where everything kind of flows through it. You look at a city like Houston that we brought up recently, that doesn't exist. Sports talk is listened to. It's a large enough city where enough people listen to it, but it's not nearly one of the top listened to items or radio stations on the playlist. In fact, it's below Spanish music, Spanish pop radio in the city of Houston. Whereas you look at a city like Cleveland, where sports talk is king. You know, so not only does the fan base drive what is happening in Cleveland, but also the fact that sports talk, the level of the kind of controversy that is stirred up on ESPN on a daily basis with national stories, the local news guys, the local guys are stirring the pot as well. People like to engage in Cleveland, and therefore I think that starts to turn the tide too.
It's all the disadvantages of a major market like New York in terms of that, and it's also all the disadvantages of a smaller market like Cincinnati in terms of we can't get free agents to come here, we can't get maybe the best coaches to come here. It has a lot of disadvantages built into it. And I think this carries through for all sports in Cleveland. And this is why we cannot see sustained success in Cleveland. The Indians are the closest example of the best run sports organization in Cleveland. The Cavaliers are not close. LeBron James is the only successful sports entity that's been in Cleveland for a sustained period of time. Literally one player. One player did all of those things. And the Indians, yes, World Series now and then, but they're a middle-tier organization in Major League Baseball. You know that. I know that. And we're about to see them go through another downturn here after they missed their World Series window in 2016 with the loss to the Chicago Cubs. This is how Cleveland is. This is how they're going to be. And I just don't ever see this changing. The thing you need to establish if you're the Cleveland Browns is this is what we expect from our head coach. We expect, one, leadership qualities, discipline, all these things that Freddie Kitchens hasn't demonstrated. And beyond all these systemic problems we've talked about, there are some real, real bad problems with the Cleveland Browns this year. Their organization, from a head coach perspective, their play calling has been atrocious. The off-field issues have been atrocious. There's been sideline controversies. There's been bad quotes in press conferences. It just doesn't feel like this organization knows what they're doing at all, especially Freddie Kitchens on the way down. And if they keep Freddie Kitchens moving into next year, next season will be another lost season. And this sophomore, everybody's calling Baker Mayfield a sophomore slump. This is the worst sophomore slump possibly ever from a guy that had that good of a rookie season, right? You can make an argument Brett Favre in his second year starting was pretty rough, but he still wasn't even as bad as Baker Mayfield has been. Baker Mayfield has been one of the worst starters in the league. You cannot have another year like this if you're Cleveland. And if Freddie Kitchens is the reason for it, you bring him back and he fails again, Freddie and Baker, they go below 500 with this type of talent, you've crashed again and you were going to be looking for a quarterback in the draft once again and you'll have wasted what I called Baker Mayfield a bust. I was wrong. I don't think he was the number one overall pick, though. I think he's a solid NFL quarterback. I think he's got a chance to be a Pro Bowler, a 10-year guy, a guy that makes the playoffs, a guy that participates in the playoffs. But you're in a point in the NFL where if you make too many mistakes in a row, you ruin guys' careers, and it becomes a situation that feels like it cannot be saved.
Yeah, well, and I think that's the scariest thing about Cleveland is the idea that there's this long list of how many guys' careers can you ruin, you know, and at times they've tried to salvage guys' careers by letting them move on, go somewhere else. Trent Richardson is an example, trading him away after they really failed him and failed creating something. But Cleveland is also just such an odd city where something seems like it could be so successful, and not only does the city make it fail, but sometimes it seems like the players do too. I mean, like, I think Peyton Hillis is a really great example. You go look at a guy who was a well over 1,000-yard rusher. He was on the cover
of Madden.
Of yeah. Madden.
Not that that's been a good sign for athletes.
No, but still, you know, I mean, it, other guys have been on the cover of Madden, and it's been totally fine. Ray Lewis, Tom Brady, etc. And it just, again, it goes back to this mold of, it's like, Baker Mayfield, you felt like was stepping into the shoes of maturity. He totally stepped back. Peyton Hillis, we all thought this was a cool guy, and then all of a sudden, he starts to get this little media moment, and he all of a sudden totally implodes. And I'm not just talking on the field, but I'm talking just storylines as well. And I think that continues to be the city of Cleveland. I will say this. Every article that's written, every analytic that's looked at, one of the things about Cleveland is that citywide, when you take out the actual players' mold, when you talk about involving analytics and surveys on what cities do players want to go to, what cities do coaches want to go to, what is the opportunity based upon the fan base? Are they loyal? Are they overbearing? Right? Cleveland is consistently listed last as being the most disadvantageous franchise to be a part of in the NFL, listed even below the Cincinnati Bengals, listed below the former San Diego Chargers, now LA Chargers. At the Washington Post, I was reading an article this morning from 2018 talking about how in every model that people look at where NFL teams are moving, you know, you might move Arizona, probably not going to happen, but sometimes that happens in some models. In some models, you might move the Bengals, etc. But in every single model, the Cleveland Browns would move in any other situation just because of the way they've been run as an organization. But again, because of the loyalty of the fan base that exists there, they're not going to move. And the only other real small market team in the NFL that has had success and will continue to have success because it played in early Super Bowls and has won championships in its entirety is the Green Bay Packers. And that's just because they're an absolute outlier. It's not because they, you know, are necessarily run better now. It's because they had a better start, right?
And nobody wants to really play in Green Bay.
No,
they're just a well-run organization.
Yeah, great organization. They draft great quarterbacks. Would Rodgers have sit that long, you know, relatively comfortably anywhere else? Probably not. But you're sitting behind Brett Favre, and eventually they gave you your shot, and now you go and bring a Super Bowl back to the City of Champions. So,
yeah, it's just a difficult situation for Cleveland. But you mentioned, and Browns fans scream at the top of their lungs, we're better than the Bengals, we're better than the Bengals, we're a better organization. Here's the bottom line. From 2011 to 2015, only the Seahawks, Packers, and Patriots had more wins than the Cincinnati Bengals. I get they didn't win a playoff game, but the Browns can't even sniff that type of success in any sort of recent era. Even if you go 2000 to 2010, one playoff appearance for the Browns, two for the Bengals, right? They have won. The Cincinnati Bengals have been better than the Browns in every decade since the Bengals existed outside of the 1990s. The 80s, even. The Browns can make an argument, oh, we made two AFC championships. The drive, we were right there. We were real close. We were pretty good. Guess what the Bengals did in the 80s? They made two Super Bowls. So the better organization in the state of Ohio is Cincinnati. The better fan base, I will admit, is Cleveland. The Bengals fans are getting ridiculous. If I see one more Bengals fan say that we shouldn't draft Joe Burrow, yeah, get out of here. This kid 100% needs to be a Cincinnati Bengal. But I'm glad we got the Browns talk out.
Yep.
It's just one of those situations where I don't really want to stand on the table anymore and say, because I think this was predictable. Freddie Kitchens was a guy who was clearly underqualified for the position of head coach. There were rumors that he wasn't even the reason for the offensive success late last season. Then the Bengals, who had a historically bad defense, were the reason Baker had 7 touchdowns, no interceptions, and a boatload of yardage. So if you take out one of the worst defenses ever from the back end of Baker's run, he was a pretty good rookie, but not this blow-me-away up-and-coming MVP candidate. You add in an experienced head coach, you add in all the drama, OBJ, you take away an offensive lineman. This was something that you should have seen coming, Cleveland. And the fact that Browns fans somehow tricked themselves into thinking that this wasn't coming, that this was a team that should win the AFC North, kind of blew me away because the signs were 100% there. Well, some early signs are now out, Max, for the Rise of Skywalker. And all the early signs are fantastic. There's a few reviewers I trust on the internet. They're nerdy Star Wars fans. And the early tweets are coming out. And people love this movie early. They're excited about it. They're saying it's going to leave you in tears. They're saying it's going to just be a satisfying conclusion to the Skywalker saga. I am unbelievably excited for this movie. I'm frankly less excited than I have been because of the wonderful show, The Mandalorian, so I've been getting my Star Wars fix. But as this gets closer and closer, and I'm seeing it on Thursday, we're recording this on a Tuesday, I can't even believe it's here. The end of this Skywalker saga, the end of this era of films, which has completely defined the first 21 years of my life, and it's coming to an end, quote-unquote, on Thursday. I'm unbelievably excited for it.
Yeah, no, and so am I. One of the cool things about Star Wars was something that we've talked about with our families. I was noticing it on Facebook recently, is that, you know, we are, this has become that family tradition. You know, you go back to my dad and his family, my Nana dropping them off at the movie theater, watching the very first Star Wars. And then eventually, you know, our dads introducing the generation of cousins and and parents and moms included, dads and moms both introducing our generations of cousins to the Star Wars saga. And then most recently, you know, we're finally old enough that we get to go and experience this amazing thing at the movies together with those parents, which is really cool. And now that kind of comes to a close. It never will truly come to a close. I'm sure that, you know, sure, maybe finally this saga is over. I don't know.
No, this one's a, like, you know,
but these storylines will at some point cross over in other forms, in other movies. You know what I mean?
But 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
We've finally gotten to this finish where it's going to be, it can't be anything but satisfying, because the one thing that I have found is that those super fans who have existed from the beginning, my dad, I think people like Troy Bolin, you know, friend of ours, you know, even though there were questions, even though there were some things that weren't perfect each time, with six, when it ended, that felt good. That felt right. That was great. Loved it. Three ended, wow, unbelievable, answered all of our questions. You know, we understand the background of these characters. Wow, really cool. And so I expect nothing but the same here with episode nine.
Yeah, one of the trailers came out, and, you know, there's a moment there when C-3PO kind of looks up, and Poe asks him, I think he asked him what's wrong. I'm not sure what he asked him. And C-3PO, and he's like, I'm just taking one last look at my friends. Right, that moment, even when I speak of it, it invokes, it really does invoke tears in my eyes. And I'm not trying to be dramatic. I'm not trying to be anything like this. But Star Wars, to me, has defined childhood. And everybody says, oh, it defined my childhood, defined my childhood. But let me put a bigger emphasis on it. Since I was a boy, right, every time Star Wars was on, it was an unbelievably positive experience. And it has carried through that time and time again. It was what I watched with my dad. It was something that we experienced together. It was the toys I played with. It was the toys I bought. And as an only child who lets his imagination run quite a bit, Star Wars had an unbelievably special place in my heart from age three on. And this story, 1, 2, 3, which I got to see when I was a kid, it felt like the end then. And I was reignited for my passion with Star Wars with the release of Episode 7. And that kind of brought it back. And through one of the harder points of my life, which is the end of high school, which you know can be difficult. Anybody knows that it can be difficult. Through the start of college, through this entire transformative period, somehow, some way, my life has lined up to where this Star Wars has grown, developed. I could have fallen in love with it. And then it reignited my sense of childlike ambition by its reappearance in our world. And the fact that it matched up perfectly in that, you know, I've made this move to the city of Chicago somehow at the same time that this series ends. So one era of my life has concluded. And as this new era begins, this saga comes to an end. This saga that is defined every, like, childlike moment I can really remember, every moment of pure joy is Star Wars-based or sports-based, but essentially Star Wars-based. And it's just going to be really emotional for me to see that, because it's not emotional that I'm sad it's going to end. It's emotional because I can't believe that I was taken on this type of journey by something that was completely made up, you know, by something that was made up by a man named George in 1977, a man that was denied by a few studios before it was allowed to be, even be put on. It's incredible. I'm excited for it. It's just every time I've had it on, man, it's just, it's unbelievably overwhelming.
Well, and you keep talking about, you know, the movies, but also there's this wonderful narrative of right now, it's kind of mind-boggling that we're in the midst of this Mandalorian saga as well that has kind of entrenched everyone as well on Disney Plus. And when it first came out, you said, oh, Disney Plus has taken over. And then I kind of rephrased that and said, well, I don't really think that, you know, Disney has some wonderful stuff. I love their old classic cartoons and animations. I love, you know, some of the reincarnations of some of their best stories. But really what it is Star Wars taking over. I mean, you literally have millions, not thousands, but you have millions of people who are subscribing to Disney Plus only for the fact that The Mandalorian is on there. Or at least that's the largest part of the reason. You know, they get 30% towards wanting to have a subscription on Disney Plus, and The Mandalorian is what puts them over the top, or whatever it may be. And I think that's the thing that's so interesting about this story that I'm so excited about, is that George Lucas has truly created a universe, and the right people seem to be guiding this story and universe into the future where we're all going to get to enjoy it for years and years to come. And I know some people didn't like, you know, a solo story, or some people didn't like Rogue One, or some people even had major issues with the last couple of movies. But at the end of the day, the one thing that I noticed time and time again is that when people came out of these movies, they normally pretty much are grinning ear to ear, is one of the best ways to put it. I saw a reviewer say that the other day. Dan Casey came out and he said, "All I can say is wow. Star Wars: The Rise of Skywalker is many things, and long story short, I'm grinning ear to ear." And then he, you know, also followed up in a tweet at the bottom of that saying that, you know, "I'm going to think about it, and I'm sure that there will be things to nitpick." And I think that's the thing that we've learned. Since we all love the Star Wars universe so much, we all have our own opinion and are able to interject that at all times. But that's also what makes it so beautiful, is that those of us who want to nerd out over Star Wars can. It is one of those great conversation starters. It's like a good football game. Or there are some of us who don't want to talk about it. We just want to appreciate it and smile when we're done. And that's okay, too. That's when you know you've created something truly great.
Yeah, and, you know, we can go through all those things, and I love breaking the movies down. But there's just no better feeling than sitting down in the theater, having not seen the film, and especially these saga films. Because Solo was a little different, right? Solo had a little bit different of a feel. It was kind of this fun action-adventure set in the Star Wars universe. And Rogue One was really cool, too. But for every saga film, especially since I became, because when I was a kid, it was just cool, it was Star Wars. But because you fell in love with it through that space and time, every time I've sat in the theater for 7 and 8, especially, you sit down in the theater, right? And you've watched the trailers, you've thought about what could happen, you've seen all the past movies, you've definitely marathoned up to it. At least most Star Wars fans do, and this is 100% what I do. And you sit down, and you have your popcorn, and your friends are there, and there's people you love that are with you, and you don't know what's going to happen. And there's no better feeling in the world. Honestly, I've not felt a feeling that's better than sitting there, the trailer's finally ending, and that small blue text coming up on the screen, "A long time ago in a galaxy far, far away."
You're getting me excited. That's all I can say, man.
Boom. It flips, and it says Star Wars. In both 7 and 8, and I 100% guarantee in 2 days the same thing will happen to me. I am overwhelmed with emotion that moves me to tears in the theater. And it's simply for the fact that, because in sports I've been harmed, right? Sports has harmed us. We've had expectations. We've had things taken away. The 2015 playoff game.
Ooh,
man.
Don't even talk about it.
You know, I don't want to, like...
Why do we have to bring it up so often?
Yeah, for the Cincinnati Bengals, like, that was emotionally damaging to me. No matter how bad a Star Wars...
Buster Posey's Grand Slam was emotionally damaging to me.
Yeah, that was rough, too. Right? So, time and time again, sports has damaged us. And sports has given us a lot of fantastic moments as well. But it does not have this childlike purity. Star Wars has never hurt me. Star Wars has never made me regret liking it. All Star Wars has done is every time it is on, taken me back to a time and place, and I want everybody to go back to that time and place. Just close your eyes and think about it. Where there is nothing wrong with the world. When you were a kid, when all that mattered was that day, what toys you were going to play with, and what mom was going to make for dinner. Like those times, especially for... you know, some of us that had things happen throughout childhood that weren't exactly the best. Those things are unbelievably precious. And both with 7 and 8, and I will do with 9, when it says "a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away," and Star Wars flashes and the music plays and sends shivers through your spine, those moments, like, it's just pure joy. There's nothing wrong with that moment. You haven't seen anything. You have no idea what's going to come next. All you know is that for the next 2.5 hours or so, you get to be a kid again. And that is something that cannot be replicated by anything on this earth. And that's what Star Wars means to me, is those moments. And I'm so excited so unbelievably excited to have that moment at least one more time in a theater with a story that I'm so connected to. And it's just emotional. It's an emotional thing for me. It's not even, and it's why I have a hard time criticizing any Star Wars property.
Yeah, well, and this thing too is that each Star Wars kind of does its own thing very well. I mean, I think I was critical for a moment of what Rian Johnson did, but then got on board with it. Same thing. You know, every now and then you see something in The Mandalorian, even critical of it. I will say one of the things ironic of all of these new movies I've never been critical of, and probably won't. Like, I was a really big fan of the Rogue One adventure. And one of the reasons I felt like I was because it was there was some good fan service, like, in that movie. It answered some questions that we had. It introduced us to some really cool characters, but then also it kind of didn't matter anymore. And that's the cool thing that I've seen about this movie in general that I'm so excited for, is that I think it's going to do a lot of those same things. That's why I love that movie so much. That's why a lot of people loved some of the really funny, interesting moments in Episode 1, Phantom Menace, when the new trilogy first came out, was because there were moments literally that were just guided towards you, reminding you what it was like seeing a character on the movie screen for the first time. And then, boom, they pop up in this movie for the first time. And I think this movie's going to have a lot of that in it. So it's very exciting. Like you said, it's emotionally stirring. It's so exciting. And it's going to be one of those things that, you know, we're only going to be able to rave about, I'm sure. At some point, we'll be able to nitpick it. But over the next 2 weeks, we'll only be able to rave about it when we go and see it for the fifth time.
Yeah, I can't even, like, I will not be able to come out of the movie and fairly evaluate it as a film, right? Because I like evaluating films like a critic would, right? Pacing of a script and where are the lulls and was the writing bad and did they force something and did you like the development of this character? And I can go through an honest evaluation of all the Star Wars movies. Like, for me, in terms of film quality, the film quality order of my Star Wars, so everybody has their Star Wars order, right? I don't know if you have yours on the top of the head. We could probably do that real quick before we see Rise of Skywalker. But in terms of film quality, I think Empire Strikes Back is the best film in terms of, one, the technology they had available at the time, what they were doing was incredible. The scripting, the pacing, the directing, the shots, the drama, the cliffhangers, all those things in terms of film, check all the boxes. It's an incredible piece of filmmaking. But it's not my favorite Star Wars movie. My favorite Star Wars movie, every time I sit down and watch it, is Episode 3. Why? I don't know. Maybe it's because of the time I saw it. It was the first one I really, really remember clearly seeing in theaters multiple times. Maybe that's emotional connection. But I think those two things are completely different things. So when I walk out of Episode 9, there's no way I'm going to be able to evaluate it as a film. It's because I was just a kid for 2.5 hours being taken on whatever adventure they're taking us on, and trying to guess what's happening next and just kind of living in the moment. This is another reason why I see these movies 3, 4, 5 times, because it's so hard to evaluate on first viewing, especially when you have so much love for the property.
Well, and one of the things you're talking about your favorite movies, the way that I look at Star Wars a lot is that, especially now that different directors are taking on the different stories, is that right now anything that's involved a Skywalker, so 4, 5, 6 and on, so 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 and 9 will involve the Skywalkers, obviously. Almost all of those movies in some way, shape, or form have to do mostly at some point along the way with blowing up the massive death ray that is the Death Star or whatever the term it's taking on in that movie. And that's the thing about Episode 5, Empire Strikes Back, is of that group and including, that's the movie, and including the last one, was it Last Jedi?
Yeah.
Those two movies are the ones that don't involve blowing up this massive.
They're very personal stories.
So they become stories where it's kind of like someone who takes a Shakespeare story and you're following a storyline, and guess what, man, I really love A New Hope. I really love Return of the Jedi. And both of those have these kind of mirrors. They're both told really well, but a little bit differently. And in the end, they blow it up. They win. It's awesome. It's great, right? Episode 5 is all of these nuances, right? Episode 7, same thing. It's like, oh, this is Star Wars, right? This is what Star Wars is, right? It's not all the political drama of episodes 1, 2, and even 3. It's not the development of the characters. No, it's just this is Star Wars. But then episode 8, again, we had to take a step back because it was like, oh, once again, this is a little bit of the politics, right? We see the galaxy and how, you know, no problems have been ultimately solved yet. We also see our characters and their side stories and even those who we think are good, but maybe they have bad, whatever. And that's the thing is that, you know, Star Wars is great in two different ways. It can be told as Star Wars, which is that story where good prevails, or it can be told as this interesting politicization of the world where it's like, who is good? What is good? You know, and what does it mean to you? And where do you find your courage to take up your spot and to pursue your own destiny? And my hope is that this final movie is able to mix those two things. Everything that is Star Wars and then that everything that is the drama and politics of Star Wars into one.
Yeah, well, I think that each of the set of films, the villain in it kind of reflects whatever the modern villain of the time is. So when you take a look at the 70s and 80s, it's the Empire, it's this faceless enemy, and that's what the 70s and 80s were about. It was about the Russians, it was about a faceless enemy. You look at the early 2000s, the enemy was inside. The enemy was the government. The enemy was conspiracy, and we remember how the early 2000s were. With conspiracy theories and all those things running amok and running about, whether they're true or not, that's another podcast for another day. But that was kind of the enemy of the time. And Kylo Ren, this disturbed teenager, is the enemy of our time, right? You know, the horrible school shootings, people that are mentally shaken by something and are driven to a place that you didn't imagine possible. That is the enemy of our time. This teen, right, that just got led astray. And I really like how it reflects society in those ways. Okay, let's do these movie rankings. Before, and I'm putting you on the spot a bit here, Max, but we'll do the movie rankings out. And what I said about The Last Jedi, and I want this to be noted, I really think there's a chance we walk out of The Rise of Skywalker and we like The Last Jedi more because of it. I think The Last Jedi set itself up to be reliant on its sequel. And how it answers a lot of those questions that it posed in The Last Jedi. But that all remains to be seen. For me, we'll rank the 10. It's 10, right? Yeah, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, Rogue One, and Solo.
Yep.
And we won't do the Clone Wars.
And Solo is set about a decade before A New Hope.
Yeah.
And Rogue One ends, obviously, literally
right before
moments before A New Hope begins. So
for me, my favorites, I'm just going to do my favorite Star Wars movie. It goes Episode 3 is my favorite, bar none. And then for me, it's Episode 5, 7, and then I would go, yeah, it's 3, 5, 7. And then I would go 6, 8. Actually, before 7, above 7, I'd put Rogue One. And then just below 8, I would put Solo. And then you kind of get into the prequel era. And then I would put, actually, Episode 4, A New Hope, is just above Episode 1 and 2. So from bottom up, it's 1, 2, then New Hope. Then I would put Solo, then I'd put Episode 8, then I would put 7, then I'd put Rogue One, and I'd put 6 below 7, and I know it's getting really confusing, and then I would put 3 and 5 at the top, with Episode 3 as my favorite. So that's essentially my list. I know it was confusing.
No, that's good. Well, the way that my list has always gone, even though I'm the type of person literally who can sit, enjoy, appreciate all the movies, I'm a little bit different than you because I'll start with Revenge of the Sith is my bottom. It's my least favorite movie, but that's because I feel like it's so excruciating to watch. It has nothing. It has not. And I don't mean the pain and agony of you know watching Anakin Skywalker truly become Darth Vader or anything like that. I just mean it's a very long movie. You know, Hayden Christensen is a tough actor to watch, and obviously he's very important in that movie. And so That was kind of difficult for me. So that movie is on the bottom. However, at the same time, I look at it as a great movie in the sense that I really enjoyed watching it when I've watched it. And I honestly think I've probably only watched that movie all the way through twice just because it is so excruciating.
Well, it's
and
sad.
It's so much. Very
it's
sad.
Sad. Like, if you get through how sad it is.
Yeah, so that movie is my bottom, whereas Return of the Jedi is my favorite movie. Reason being is it's kind of that first conclusion of the series. Really enjoyed that. Really enjoyed the role that all the characters played. Darth Vader is my favorite character in the Star Wars series. So to see him take that full journey to become the balance of the Force, so to speak, again in Return of the Jedi, I loved. Phantom Menace is my second favorite movie, and I think that's partially because, again, loving Vader so much, you get this first introduction to this kid, this child who has so much power but doesn't really know how to use it and doesn't know what it is. It's kind of like a five-star athlete. You know, they don't really know how to use their strengths, but they need someone to guide them. And at the end of the day, the one person who believed in him dies in that movie. So you see the beginning of that evolution. And Phantom Menace has the greatest. I mean, that battle with Darth Maul is just incredible. I will sit and listen to Duel of the Fates without even watching the battle. I just think that's an incredible song, and that's a lot of fun. So my favorite's Return of the Jedi. Second is Phantom Menace. After that, I would say Empire Strikes Back. I think A New Hope follows that, probably closely tied with Rogue One. After that one, I would go maybe Attack of the Clones. And then that's when you get into the new series. I can't tell you where they fit yet. You know, I love The Last Jedi, you know.
What you like better, 7 or 8?
I like The Force Awakens more because, again, it followed that true Star Wars. But I still don't think it has beaten anything other than Revenge of the Sith for me yet. You know, and again, Revenge of the Sith, great story, but just, you know, a scary movie. but again, Return of the Jedi and The Phantom Menace are by far my two favorites. And I hope, again, the thing that I laid out as to what Star Wars was, I think Return of the Jedi is Star Wars. It is everything that you expect out of a Star Wars storyline and plot. The Phantom Menace is that somewhat of a balance of funny slash politics slash, again, Star Wars story, let's blow up something being at the end. And again, I think the reason I like those two is because they have that balance in them.
Yeah, to me, Episode 6 would be way higher if the Ewoks were Wookiees instead of Ewoks. I think that the Ewoks take it out of me about every time I see them in Episode 6, and I really like that episode. The Ewoks kind of, And then Episode 4 to me is actually boring because I've seen so much of the Star Wars universe. If you're not new to it, Episode 4 is just all these baseline characters, and it's so cool because it's the start of Star Wars, right? You appreciate it, but again, it was made in 1977. It's all these characters that you already kind of know their paths forward. There's some decisions in that movie in terms of how quick Luke moves on emotionally from certain characters that are somewhat confusing. And just Episode 4 to me, if you ask me, I had to sit down and I got to take one Star Wars movie with me to an island, right, for the rest of my life. It would definitely wouldn't be Episode 4. I'm not sure it would be Episode 3. I want to see Episode 9 might be it, because Episode 9, what J.J. Abrams' goal with this film is to tie all of them together.
The one I'd take to me on the island is definitely Phantom Menace. Are you kidding me? I get to watch Liam Neeson's acting. We get Ewan McGregor, so you get a little bit of Obi-Wan.
Yeah. But you have to watch Jar Jar Binks.
You know what? I don't hate Jar Jar Binks the way everybody else does. I think it's funny character, annoying, but adds a little bit of comedy, and I actually like the what's the name of the Gungans?
Yes,
I actually really like the Gungans.
I like the Gungans.
You know, Jar Jar being the character he is a little annoying, but the Gungans are kind of fun. That underwater world, Phantom Menace is definitely the one I take to the island. Definitely,
I wouldn't take Phantom Menace. I honestly might take Rogue One, just to see that.
That's
Darth
a great,
Vader
yeah.
Scene.
That's
just to see the last scene of the film. Honestly, like, the last scene of Rogue One is the best 2 minutes of Star Wars that exists currently.
It's pretty incredible.
And then the Mandalorian's getting up there. There's some moments in there that are flying up the list. Moving on to the last segment for us, just going to talk about the city of Chicago for a second. You've lived here much longer than I have so far, although in real time, it won't be that much longer in a couple years. Just what makes this city special to you, Max? Like, what is special about the city of Chicago?
Well, I'll tell you, the thing I tell everybody as to why we moved here, Alyssa and I, is because this is a city where it's not a weekend city. I love Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh, I was there for over a year. Please, Pittsburgh people, do not take this as a knock on Pittsburgh. But I call Pittsburgh, I call Cincinnati, weekend cities. You can go and you can really do most of the fun things in that city in a single weekend. And I'm not saying in the region, yes, there's stuff to do when you drive outside of the city 45 minutes, just like there's things to do in Dayton or in Liberty Township or in Mason. But in the actual downtown, in the city itself, they're, you know, within a 20-minute distance. Those are weekend cities. Chicago is not. Our neighborhood, Lakeview East, we are still exploring. We are still exploring Lakeshore Drive, and we've already been here for 7 months. Our neighborhood, right? And I think there are very few places in the world, whether you're living in the suburbs, whether you're living in a village, whether you're living in a city, where there's a lot to do. But on a side note, when you go look at a place like New York City, there's also some great things going on, but those neighborhoods are so packed in, the buildings are so tall. You know, living in the Bronx is not the same as living in Wicker Park or Lakeview East as it is in Chicago. That's what we love about this place so much, is that there's so much to do and so much still to explore and so much changing, not just every week, but every day. It's wild.
Yeah, to me, it's a big city built for the middle class. And I think that is...
Yeah, that's very well put.
A big city built for the middle class because, yes, it's more expensive. Guess what? There's more people. It's called supply and demand. That's how this thing works. Yes, it's more expensive, but it's not necessarily New York. Like, you do not need to be superbly wealthy to have a decent apartment in Chicago, to have a decent neighborhood to live into. And, you know, I really want to dispel all those rumors about, not rumors, they're truths about our city, Max. You know, the hard truths about our city. But this is a 2.3 million, this is the third largest city in the United States. This is an incredibly large city. And a lot of the problems in this city, unfortunately, are all located in one area. That is unfortunate for those people that live in the area. But if you live outside of those areas, it is a very great city to live in if you're a part of the middle class and you want that big city experience. It's somewhat of a best of both worlds type of thing. And you get everything. Like you said, there's major sports all over the place. There's a bunch of colleges for more sports if you need that. Any type of life you want to live, I think Chicago provides it because we've got a beach that we drive by right here, right? There's a beach you can go lay on in the summer.
Yeah, no, it literally is. And also there's tons of beaches, and the beaches fill every void, right? There's the beach for the party. There's the beach for those who just want to chill out. There's the beach that we're not going to say the name because we don't want to spoil the secret, but that a lot less people go to, so it's not incredibly crowded. And again, these are the things that Chicago offers. Whatever you want, whatever experience you're looking for, Chicago's got it. It's there. It exists. And I don't think any large city in the United States, I think there are probably other large cities in the world, yes, but I don't think there's another large city in the United States that is able to offer some of the things that Chicago does.
Well, to me, I spent a lot of time in Germany. So every city in Germany, even not the largest, the city centers are much like Chicago. They're busy, they're compact, because 100 million people live in Germany in a size that's the third the size of Texas, right? They're jam-packed in. So a lot of the areas are like Chicago, but not everybody in Germany is rich, so you cannot make these places so unbelievably unaffordable. And Chicago has somehow replicated that within a big city atmosphere. It's a beautiful city to live in, it's a wonderful city, and it's the city that we're doing this podcast from, although some of this podcast probably over the next couple weeks won't be from the city of Chicago. Max and I will be making trips back to Ohio for the holidays, all those wonderful things. But I think that's going to bring an end to our first episode of On the Shore, buddy.
Yeah, this has been a pretty good start. You know, we got to talk about pretty much all of our favorite things. Got to talk badly about the Cleveland Browns as an organization. That's always fun. Got to talk about a little bit of Star Wars, and got to talk about our new city. Now I guess the question becomes, are we going to be, we live on the north side, but are we going to be south side Shy Sox fans, or are we going to be north side Cubs fans?
We can't be Cubs fans, man.
I know. It's truly
impossible.
Especially
with the Reds' rotation right now.
I think the Cubs, the White Sox are fun. I went down there to a couple of games, and it's a good ballpark. Alyssa and I had one bad experience, but that's okay. Sometimes that happens. It was a doubleheader long day. But outside of that, it was a really great experience down there in Chicago, South.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that the White Sox are a better organization than the Cubs or anything like that. No. I'm just saying that I can't be a Cubs and a Reds. It just doesn't work. Not in the sport of baseball. Not when winning the division is so crucial to everything. But not going to root against the Cubs either. But, you know, Berton. Bears are a mess. Bears and Bengals. Andy Dalton will lead the Bears next year. I'm guessing. I'm just kidding. We'll see what happens.
That sure would be something.
For sure. Well, that's going to bring it in to our first episode of On the Shore. For Max McDoolin, I'm Lucas Moore. Hey, we want to thank you so much for taking a listen. You want to make sure you follow us on Twitter. We're not going to do a Twitter page for this show. You can just follow us, and we'll post it. Figure it out. Thank you so much for listening. See you next time.